I'm very pleased to be here. In full disclosure, there is something that I have to confess here. I hate the term social entrepreneurship. It's something that comes from a legacy where, you know, it's like there's entrepreneurship and then there's social. I actually believe that these two things are going to be combined more and more so that every venture that is set up has to look at what are the environmental, social, and financial repercussions of what they are doing. And tonight what I'm going to talk about a little bit is the trends. Many of you are interested. I assume you're taking this course because of the fact that you're interested in building your businesses. And so I'm going to be talking a little bit about some of the trends that are going on in terms of new kinds of business models that are addressing these issues, but also what are the big corporations doing. And this title of Beyond CSR is really where things are headed. So I'm going to be talking about that. What I plan to do is sort of run through a couple of different points there. Please interrupt me at any point in this discussion. It looks very formal, but I really would much rather have you, you know, have it be an interactive session. If there's something that you want to clarify or don't understand or whatever. So be talking about that. How many of you actually go to Oxford? Oh my God, everybody. All right, good. So you're all enrolled in different. How many of you are MBAs? A couple of MBAs. Okay, good. So I will tell you a little bit about me wasn't introduced. I sound like a Yank. I'm actually from Ecuador, from Latin America. Is anybody here from Latin America? Oh, muy bien. But was raised until I was 17 throughout different countries in Latin America, came to the United States to do my degrees. My first life, I was an economist at the World Bank. In my second life, I was a public health doctor, and now I'm an entrepreneur. So you can go through all of these life changes as well. I think that's really important to message to convey here, is that what you study doesn't necessarily limit what you're going to go on to do, as many of these we'll talk about. The first thing I want to do is, okay, these are the objectives that I'm hoping to accomplish in this session. I basically want to review some of the emerging models that entrepreneurial ventures are moving towards that address financial sustainability as well as social and environmental mission at their core. The second thing is I want to talk about how these new ventures are similar or different to charities and mainstream bank. We're really seeing a trend of something quite different that is emerging, which is exciting, in fact, given the state of the world. The third is to really talk a little bit about what is the special role that these entrepreneurial ventures have in our societies today, and then examine some of those models. And then finally, where do these organizations, these ventures, get their capital from, given the fact that they are really sitting in between this hybrid position of actually being a startup that's really focused on changing something or transforming something about the business model that is creating inequalities or unsatisfactory equilibrium in environment or in society. Where are those people coming from who are going to actually fund these ventures? Where can you look for that kind of capital? And then the last one is looking at, which I think fascinating, what are the emerging trends in mainstream commercial sector that are actually looking at how do we rethink our model across the supply chain, across what we're doing with human resources, et cetera, so that we're actually addressing the complexity of the issues, because it's no longer okay just to say, you know what, we're just actually maximizing profit for shareholders. We really want to look at some of those. Some of that stuff on CSR is total greenwash. Most of it is total greenwash. But you're beginning to see actually transition in this space, which I think is quite exciting. So those are some of the objectives of what I'd like to accomplish tonight. I want to start out by really talking a little bit about some of these new hybrid models, which are basically, if you look at what is the definition of entrepreneurship, it is about combining innovation, resourcefulness, and opportunity. so that entrepreneurs are always looking for opportunities where they can actually step in and respond to something that they see as a market failure or a government failure in this case. And so these are hybrid ventures that recognize we really have to address a market failure or a government failure to, and there is a business opportunity here. And they do it in a very, very business-like fashion, which I'll describe. They're not focused on, let's build the next hospital, let's build the next school. They're focused on what needs to happen to transform the health sector. They are, like most entrepreneurs, completely focused on transforming what exists. The problem is that with most of us mere mortals, we don't see those opportunities because to us they're too risky. I mean, some of the examples that I'll show you tonight, you'd have to be crazy to actually see this as an opportunity. And, you know, several years ago I wrote a book called The Power of Unreasonable People, how entrepreneurs create markets to change the world. And that's really what you're seeing happening, is that these are highly imaginative, creative people who have a vision for an opportunity that others of us would see as far too risky. And as I said, to sustain their activities in this hybrid space, many times because they're responding to a market failure, they need other resources other than just earned income through contracts. And so we'll describe some of that. They're cropping up all over the world. They are really, literally cropping up all over the world. I've given you some of the examples here. The Eden Project, which I will be highlighting here in the UK. Has anybody been to Cornwall to visit the Eden Project? Okay, this is called one of the 8 wonders of the world. We'll talk very quickly about what that model is and why it's transformational. Embrace, founded by Jane Chen and co-workers, is basically responds to the fact that in many very poor rural populations, when babies are born prematurely, they die because of a lack of incubators. And what they have created has been a specific baby warmer, which is using the latest tools and technology and heated through solar power. And they are a for-profit company and doing very well. Waste Concern in Bangladesh. Anyway, I could go on, but I won't at this point because I want to just give you a little bit of a snippet of the Eden Project, tell you about, and also show you something from its founder that has something to say to people, those of you who are planning business, and where he sees business model going. But as I said, it's brought more than £1 billion into the Cornwall economy since its inception. And Tim Smith was a one-time music producer, an entrepreneur now, and one of the, he's just been knighted. He hates to be called Sir Tim. You'll see why. He's quite irreverent. And I'll show you a very quick film clip of him. Let me see. Here we are. I'm going to do this one rather than all of the other ones.
The trouble is everybody's looking for tips, aren't they, about how to run good businesses. And the worst people on earth to actually give you any tips about how to run anything are the people who are actually doing it. Because what happens in real life is that you describe your life backwards. I am here, so the reason I got here must have been for a purpose. So de facto, all those things I did must have led me here, which is utter bollocks. Because the truth is real life is about making loads and loads of mistakes, having a couple of lucky breaks along the way, and actually it's usually a razor blade difference between success and failure. It really is. I mean, the Eden Project is a case in point. Just for those of you who've never been there or know nothing about it, it's a 34-acre clay pit with a whacking great hole. We've built the world's greatest conservatories in it. We have a turnover of about £19 million a year. We've got 500-odd staff. We've contributed £930 million into the Cornish economy over the last 7 years, which is more than double the entire European funding for the whole of the Southwest over the same period. We're very political. When we built it, we always intended that we should run it as if we were around our kitchen table, because where most people go wrong, well, most men go wrong, is that they don't realise the common sense you have at your kitchen table gets completely buggered when you then go to work and feel you have to impress other men. It's true. I mean, look, come on. Would this financial crisis be with us if we had equal men and women in the boardrooms? Of course not. We know that's true. The other tips I give. So that was the Eden Project, okay? And if I'm not going to tell you any more, don't be so mean. Come and visit, right? But the things I've learnt about business are, first of all, distrust anybody who uses the word centre of excellence. Out of the box. Out of the box. Joined up thinking. Leading edge. Cutting edge. Bleeding edge, which is when I assume you're too close to the cutting edge. And make absolutely sure that you have nothing to do with anybody who thinks they're capable of thinking the unthinkable. You can't think the unthinkable. But what you can do is to sit down next to a kitchen table and realise that some of the world's great businesses were actually created around kitchen tables. And the reason they're created around kitchen tables is you're normally sensible at that point. If you want to, for those of you watching at home, don't do that. But for those of you watching at home, check out places like the Griffin Hospital near Boston. Yeah? Fantastic place. Why did it go from the worst hospital in America to the best hospital in 5 years? You know what they did? Revolutionary. They asked all the potential patients who lived around them what sort of hospital they wanted to visit and built it. Why don't we do that sort of stuff? Probably one of the best schools in the world, the Manchester School in Pittsburgh, the roughest part of Pittsburgh. It's a fantastic school because the guy who runs it, the most inspirational man I've ever seen on a stage, he has a motto about running it, which is, if it's good enough for rich folks, it's good enough for poor folks too. Wonderful. I saw 500 grown-ups cry when he spoke about what happens if you forget to put limits on people and actually assume that everybody is capable of fantastic things. Because people are fantastic things, but you actually need to believe it. What I learned in the music business before I went into Eton was something really profound, which was to shape my life, which was, if you love something yourself and you are not a freak, there will be millions and millions and millions and millions of people like you. So therefore, the only problem is marketing. Let them know about it. You've got a big market.
Amen. So we'll stop there. I highly recommend that you watch Tim's videos. He's a profoundly intelligent person. Here's another interesting. This is for-profit sustainable enterprises. The Eden Project basically started out as he tells a wonderful story of how the lottery was giving, I don't know, millions of pounds in order for the construction of projects that were going to renovate a certain region, and how he applied when the Eden Project was one big clay pit for this project, and that, you know, he had all the people gathered around him who were really excited about doing this, and they even bought a fax machine to find out whether they were going to win this pot of money or not. And he said everybody was standing around. They had given up, many of these people had totally given up their jobs to work with Tim to pursue this crazy vision of his of creating this incredible biosphere which houses every plant on the face of the earth. And he said when the facts came through, he said there were three categories. The first category was category A, we love your project, you get the money. The second category was category B. He said, we really like your project, but it could do with some more work, and we'll help you get this done. And the third category was category C, which was, as he says, don't ever darken our door again. So he got the facts, and it was category C. So he said, what do I do? I'm standing here with all these people, and they're all waiting to hear that we've won, that we're going to get this money. So he said, that's when I came up with the idea of the construction of future truths. So what he said was, he told them, let's call a press conference. He didn't say we got the money. He didn't say we didn't get the money. He called a press conference. Press came from all over Cornwall. He got up there and he said, I want to thank the Millennium Development Commission for their insight for this prize, blah, blah, blah. Point was, the Millennium Development Commission was totally confused as to whether they had given him this money or not. And that's the way he secured, I mean, you can question his ways of doing this, but that's the kind of person we're talking about, somebody who takes incredible risks and who does things because of a dream or a vision. There are a few of us like that. Now, this is a different kind of model. This isn't a hybrid. This is a pure for-profit that we're going to be talking about. I'm going to show you how these business models are really coming up with new ways of doing business in a way that is, I don't know, philosophically positive and fundamentally innovative, and also very morally compelling in terms of where people want to go and work. So it's a new form of commercial corporation. How many of you have heard of KICS or the B Corp legislation that's now coming through the United States, which has been passed in 18 states in the U.S., which allows what's called the for-benefit corporation, where in the Articles of Constitution, it's not that you are only maximizing your shareholder profit, and your shareholders agree that you have other commitments there. So it's quite an interesting and revolutionary concept that's also beginning here in the U.K. There are a couple of B corporations in the U.K. So we're seeing new forms of corporate constitution. And these are fully self-sustaining. This is a list of those. I want to tell you about two, actually, which are quite fascinating. This is a Danish man. You think that these things only happen in emerging markets, but actually, Thorkild Sohn was a landscape architect. And when his son was 5 years old, he was diagnosed with autism. How many of you are familiar with autism? Okay. The problem here with autism is the following. Autism rangers, there's a whole range. So there are those that are mildly autistic, et cetera. I don't want to get into the clinical aspects of this. But the way that Thorka was told by the people who diagnosed his son was, your son will never have a normal life. And your son will always have problems with, you know, work relationships. He probably will not be able to get a job, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the picture that I showed you of Thorka with the dandelion in the background, he said, being, you know, a landscape architect, he said, now wait a minute, look at the dandelion. The dandelion for many people is a weed, but for other people it's a medicinal plant. How can I change the attitude of society around the autistic, around people that are autistic? And what he did was he created a software testing company that employed only autistic people. And it was amazing to see, obviously, autistic people have tremendous powers of concentration. They're extremely detail-oriented, as you can imagine. And he basically created it as an IT consultancy that became one of the top IT consultancy for software testing in Denmark, and basically had, you know, major companies, major corporations as their clients. And he was really making a very decent turnover. Now, what ends up happening is, of course, people all over the world that have the situation of where they're dealing with autism realize, wow, we could actually change the way people think about autism. So here's, you know, a company that's totally reversed the way, you know, the opportunities for some in the autistic spectrum, not all, some. So there is using opportunity, resourcefulness, seeing an opportunity where any of us would have thought this is just not possible. So it's interesting to see how business can really be a mechanism to do this, and you're seeing this more and more. And the interesting thing is what happens to the people that work there. They no longer see themselves as people with problems. They see themselves as specialists, because that's what they are. And that's how they came up with this term, the specialist people. I'll go on to something very, very different, which I can strongly urge you. This is, again, a highly profitable venture, business venture, that is using business principles, market principles, to really transform a situation that is causing problems, which is the following. There are tons of materials, as you know, that go straight to landfill. And one of those materials is decommissioned fire hose. When a fire hose that firemen use all over the world or wherever breaks down after years and years and years of service, there's no opportunity, there's no way you can do anything with that except to send it to landfill. So basically, Cressy Westling and her partner, James, ended up identifying this as a huge opportunity. And what did they do? They basically said, we could completely use this material to compete in the luxury market for making bags and wallets and all kinds of very interesting, fashionable products. They created something called the Elvis and Cressy line, which today is incredibly lucrative, and they're competing with the, you know, at a much lesser level, but people are really very attracted to this, and I'll show you some of the kinds of bags and things that they produce, and also show you a little film clip about that. And what they do is they give 50% of their profits away to Fire Brigade, the UK Fire Brigade. And oftentimes, students will go, but wait, why would you do that? And she said, it's securing my supply line. Besides, I have the greatest marketing army of, who doesn't love firemen? And so we just have this great marketing, you know, potential of the firemen who are, I don't think they're firewomen, but anyway, they're mostly firemen, who are completely sold on us and are giving us all our material. They also reclaim other things like coffee sacks, et cetera. But here are some of the materials. I guarantee you, if you go on their website, beautiful stuff. So this is all fire hose. It's top stuff. Inside is made from parachutes that are no longer usable. So everything is what we call now the circular economy, which is reuse, 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 rather than waste, waste, waste. And I'll show you a very interesting little presentation that Cressy does. Many times people say, where'd you get the money to start this? And she'll tell you where she got the money to start this, which is a lesson in and of itself.
My name's Cressy, and I co-founded Elvis and Cressy about, I think, 5 years ago now. We started collecting fire hose in 2005. We make it into beautiful products and then give half of our profits to charity. I think a lot of people think you have to have a lot of money to start a business, and we didn't. We had a small, tiny budget, and we actually spent about £40 on a rotary cutting tool, which I can show you. It's now broken. This was the body of it. This was the cutting head. We spent £40 on that to make our first big order of belts. And we used the cash from those belts to invest in other equipment. So you don't always need a lot of money. Sometimes you just need a lot of effort and a lot of rolling up your sleeves and getting something done. I think the biggest thing you got to focus on is being unique. You know, you got to look at who you are, and you've got to research who that's going to be. So find out about your name. Has anybody else used your name? We've had this thing on X Factor where Little Mix was originally called Rhythmix, and that was the name of an existing charity which sent a letter to Simon Cowell, and he changed the name to Little Mix, which was great. But get on the internet, find out about your idea, see if there's anybody else doing it, and then focus on your uniqueness. Create a brand identity around what you do and who you are, because the innovation that you bring is what's going to set you apart. Don't focus on what other people are doing, but you've got to find out what your competition's like from day one. You are your brand, and you're your best marketing tool, so you've definitely got to always have something with you to show. And I have the iPhone holder, so I can take my phone out and show people how it works, and that's so sweet. But if you have a service or another kind of product that you can't carry around, then get pictures of it on your phone, get video on your phone. Video is fantastic. One thing that social enterprises tend to be really good at is working with their stakeholders. So if you are a stake on this site, or if you're putting a stake on another idea, then stay involved, because those companies and those ideas are actually going to rely on you. And it's really valuable to have feedback and people following you and people supporting you. I mean, we've got a Facebook site. When we get enough Facebook people telling us to design a new product, we go for it and we make it. So we really depend on our community. We depend on the charities we work with. We depend on the people who supply us with waste. We depend on other people in the ethical fashion industry. There's a lot of cooperation and collaboration. We do not exist in a vacuum. So you really have to look around you and take support from everyone. So if you have one of these stakes to give, you know, you are a stakeholder in an idea. Think about who you want to share your time with. Think about who you want to give ideas to. Really support those ideas. We were reading a blog, I think it was by Solitaire Townsend, and she actually highlighted this quote by Aldo Gucci. It was about how the bitterness of poor quality lasts a long time after the sweetness of low price has faded. And this really encapsulates everything that we do. We take fire hose, which is this incredibly durable, beautiful material, and there would be absolutely no point in making a very, very silly design and not having high quality craftsmanship embedded in it. It's got to be good quality. It's got to last forever. There's absolutely no point in doing what we do.
Interestingly enough, Cressy I was just at a meeting with a whole bunch of different investors. And have you all heard of Donna Karan, who is like a big fashion industry, like, you know, Pierre Cardin, et cetera? She got in touch with Cressy and said, I want to carry your whole line in my New York store. So, you know, usually these entrepreneurs are scaling very rapidly as well. So you're trying to build the business and balancing how do we continue to innovate alongside, you know, how do we continue to scale, which many times there is a sacrifice involved there. Now, let's go on and talk a little bit about how these organizations that are cropping up are quite different from government and quite different from your normal charity. As you know, the role of government is to also act as a redistributor, because there are some people who have money and a lot of people who are left out. So government, through taxes and other mechanisms, often, you know, that's why we collect taxes, that's why we, you know, support. And many times, you know, government can't do enough. And that's where charities step in. Charities are really operate in a very distinctive role within our society, very important. They are filling that redistributive function for people who have dropped out of the system or at the really do not have the same standard or opportunities as others. The difference is, with these ventures, they're aiming on actually changing the system, whereas charities like homeless charities, like soup kitchens, like, you know, people who address violence against women, they're much more, how do we help in a palliative way rather than a transformational way? How do we help people? They're not really addressing the root causes of the problem. They're, you know, scratching away at something, but not really looking at how do we transform the system. Albeit they function, we could not function without charities. We're not talking about charities here. We're talking about business models and how do you use the market to perform functions in certain ways that it hasn't been used to before. And so what we've seen is a trend away from the hand out, much more to how do we facilitate the hand up, very much along the lines of helping people help themselves. I think we'll see many examples of this as I keep going. Another thing is the difference between these guys and activists. You might say, well, so Cressy Wessling is obviously an environmental entrepreneur. She's a real activist around. Yes and no. Activists, or Tim. Tim's another one. Tim definitely could be labeled as an activist, except there's a very different category here. Activists are extremely important in a society. Again, just like charities, they fulfill a very specific function. When governments don't act through the usual mechanisms, social activists are out there saying, hey, you're not doing your job. They're out there protesting. They're out there, you know, whether it's Greenpeace or Amnesty International, holding corporations, holding governments to account. Okay? The difference between social activists and these entrepreneurs is that entrepreneurs are providing the tool or the solution. If you take Muhammad Yunus, who I'm sure you've heard of, his connection to Grameen Bank, microfinance, Yunus didn't sit there and go, you know, banks are unfair to the poor, and carry placards around the street saying banks are unfair to the poor. He came up with a tool that would actually help the banking industry completely reform the way they did business with the poor. So these kinds of entrepreneurs, like all entrepreneurs, are very pragmatic and very solution oriented. Mind you, we need the activists, we need the green pieces of the world, but that's not the role that these entrepreneurs that I'm talking about play. So I wanted to differentiate very much between normal charity that is important, activists that are important. This is a new kind of actor that's using business models to fulfill different functions. What about the difference between mainstream business? And I think this is one of the things I think that, you know, for years I was very involved with the World Economic Forum. It was very interesting to see how even the major CEOs of leading industries, leading companies, would go, you know, my life is divided between this is where I make my money, but what, you know, and this is where I do good. We've kind of compartmentalized those. And that's where you had the CSR push. Oh, here we're going to make our money over here. And then we're going to do stuff around charities and et cetera, et cetera. And many times it had nothing to do with their core business. That's changing, although not fast enough, but it is changing. So that you are beginning to see a coming together of, it's not just about dividing, because as Sir Stephen Green, who, if you've read Good Value, he was the chair of HSBC, and now he's, I believe, a minister of trade in the UK government. And basically what he says is compartmentalization is the curse of mankind, because if we keep bifurcating where we live our lives, this is my public face, this is my private face, and never bringing those spheres together, we will definitely have, you know, have challenges. So the main challenge for mainstream business from his perspective is how do we break down those walls? And how do we actually operate in a way that's a more holistic and true to ourselves? And this is the quote from him. So these are some new ways that we're seeing that business is being done. Managing for the long term, not just the short term. We've heard about, you know, the tyranny of the market with those quarterly returns. People are beginning to question that. Mainstream companies are beginning to question that. And that's where the B Corporation came into being, because they were beginning to question that. And so how do you balance that between cooperation with many stakeholders and competition, especially in the business space? That's another aspect. And you're basically seeing, in fact, competitors in pre-market situations collaborating with one another. I'll give you a very specific example. We had a roundtable with the main competitors of sports apparel who were being, Nike was going to be taken to task by Greenpeace for the use of some sort of chemical on the shoes that they were using. And Nike said, hang on, we're not the only ones that are using this toxic chemical. Adidas does, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So if you're going to address this issue, we need to address it together. And so these competitors came together, pre-competitor, to sort of lay out a roadmap for how they were going to deal with actually doing away with using this particular toxic ingredient in the manufacturing of their footwear by a certain date. So you're seeing a lot of that kind of cooperation before pre-competitive, I would call it. The other thing I think that we also are becoming more and more aware of, certainly here in the business school, in the issue of accounting. Pushing off all your negative externalities and basically saying, oh, we're not gonna address the externalities that our product is causing. We're just gonna, in our accounting systems, we're accounting for, you know, a completely different set of profit indicators. And now we're having this more and more, this idea of full cost accounting. How much is your company, how many goods and how many bads is your company producing? And having that come into a full cost accounting mechanism that really talks about the value to society and to your consumers that your company is providing. And so anyway, the whole marketing and branding thing. Now, let's look at corporations and charity, just what I said. You know, basically, the whole trend has been let's put on some, you know, CSR, corporate social responsibility activities onto our mainstream stuff, but, you know, that's over here. And many times, you know, you'll have banks doing stuff for something that's totally irrelevant to their core business. That, as I said, is changing. The other role that I think that sustainable enterprises really contribute, and you can see this in many of these areas, all of these areas, renewables, microfinance, affordable housing, mobile banking, all of these industries were created by entrepreneurs who saw an opportunity where business would not go because the risks were way too high in comparison to the profits that could be made. They saw it as way too risky. Today, what these enterprises do is they pave the way for mainstream business to come in. Now you have mobile banking all over Africa, for example, and highly lucrative. You certainly, renewable energy was started by, you know, entrepreneurs up in Denmark with wind farms and solar energy, where mainstream commercial investment would not go. Now it's an entire industry. So that's one of the roles. They are harbingers for new business opportunities, new ways of doing things, and that actually is one of the reasons why I get really excited about this space. I think that one of the differences with mainstream businesses and with these enterprises is that mainstream business really looks at the unit of analysis is the company. That is the unit of analysis, whereas the unit of analysis in sustainable entrepreneuring is the entire system. And basically you'll find many times these mainstream businesses are saying we need to control what's happening within our company, which yes, that's the usual way of doing business. Whereas what sustainable enterprises are doing is to really look at the broader picture and to achieve lasting solutions. So you're seeing this shift, and it's not, I'm presenting it in a very black and white way, because many mainstream businesses, I sit on the boards of a couple of publicly listed companies, are very much conscious of this shift. It's very difficult for them to pivot, however, but it is happening, which is exciting. Now we're going to get into where's the money going to come from for this. How many of you have heard of impact investing? A couple of you. Okay, what is impact investing? This is a whole new trend. There's a great enthusiasm for this idea called impact investing, and many of our students who are doing their MBAs here, this is a space that they really want to get into. It's the idea of how do you use finance to actually create a financial return for these kinds of ventures, but at the same time, ventures that are really doing and generating positive social and environmental returns. And many times I hear people going, wait a minute, you know, this is crazy. I mean, I'm creating jobs. That's enough for me. I mean, I'm creating jobs. That's a big, big deal of being an entrepreneur. Yeah, sure, the mafia creates jobs. And, you know, so does the tobacco industry. But so that's not enough, frankly, even though jobs are a great thing, and that's why we really want to foster entrepreneurship and the growth of companies because of jobs. But it's not enough in this space. So at the last G8 meeting, this was the hottest topic, according to The Economist, this impact investing. And yet, really, very small amount of capital that's out there is actually going into these investments. We're still in a very nascent stage of a new industry, which is quite interesting. The other problem is there's a huge confusion on what is impact investing. Some people say, oh, it's actually impact investing is... if I'm supporting a charity, I'm actually making an impact investment. Others are going, no. You actually have to have a financial return when you're doing impact investing. It's not enough to just give to charity and say, okay, I'm making an impact investment. So there's a lot of confusion here. And I'm on the G8, one of the task forces in the UK that the G8 has asked to look into this particular space, which is businesses that are very actively delivering social value and where the investment for that's going to come from, or what they call mission-locked businesses, social businesses. Give you a very specific example. How many of you heard of Delight in India? This is a social business basically created by two Stanford grads who really wanted to focus on how do we lessen the impact from noxic kerosene, et cetera, that the poor have to use in order to light their homes. So they basically, this is their achievements. They've improved lighting to more than 16 million people at this point, and that's how much money they've saved. They had $20 million of investment from a couple of impact investors. That's the amount of money that they've actually saved consumers. Now mainstream investors are starting to get into this space saying, hey, you know what? There's a financial return here to be made. And so that is something that has sort of, you know, sparked people's interest. And so what they're hoping to do, reach 100 million of the 2 billion users. Now, this is a big business opportunity for an impact investor that wants to get a financial return, okay? And the financial return I'm talking about here, you know, could be, you know, market rate or just below market rate, but at this point, they are looking at market rate returns. But there's another one. This is a case in Brazil, the Associação Saúde Criança, basically started by a pediatrician in a hospital that was the reference hospital for the poorest areas around Rio de Janeiro, the favelas. And she got very tired. Her name was Vera Cordeiro. She got very tired of seeing the same kids coming through the door of the hospital with the same disease week after week. They would, you know, they would get the medical attention they needed, and then they would be dismissed or sent home. And she said, you know, this is crazy. These kids, they're not. There's nothing I can do about the situation they're living in, because this is caused by poverty. It's nothing that medicine is going to be able to solve. So what she did was she quit her job, at the hospital, and she formed a very strong link with the hospital, but with the rest of society, and said, we're going to address the issues that this child is living in, which usually was the mother had no job. It was usually a female, single-headed, you know, household. The housing conditions were terrible, a whole series of things that were causing that illness. Today, that it's been amazing. She linked closely with the hospital, and she basically said, send me the kids that keep coming through your door, the same kids that keep coming through your door, and those are the kids we're going to work with. And so what she did was she and her army of different people coming from these different sectors, housing, nutrition, et cetera, would actually work with that mother or the family in terms of, for a whole year, to help her get to a point where she was going to be able to sustain a job with specific skills, et cetera, et cetera. And the recidivism rate in the hospital dropped by 60%. Today, she is here. Today, it's been replicated in more than 23 centers. Now, this is really interesting because how many of you have heard of social impact bonds, the SIBs, the famous SIBs here? Social impact bond is an extremely creative financial instrument that was developed here in the UK and has attracted tremendous interest in many other countries, US, Canada, Australia, etc. And the idea is the following. There are some ventures that are going to need funding. This venture, obviously, is never going to give anybody a financial return. It depends on philanthropic dollars. But it is saving society a huge amount of money. It's saving government a huge amount of money. So how can government reward those ventures that are basically addressing huge market or government failures in a way that helps and support their activities? And what it does is it creates a bond that you invest in and is dependent on the success of the delivery of, let's say in this case, kids who don't keep going through the revolving door. And so they have a certain time frame, a certain horizon. It is measured by independent evaluators. There's an experiment going on right now here in the UK with prison recidivism, where the people invest in that bond. It's a long-term bond, and you get a market rate return if certain goals are met. If those goals aren't met, you lose every penny. Or it's a philanthropic donation. So this seems to have caught on in a way that's interesting, and that's being called an impact investing. For me, it's a fancy and very innovative way of doing effective philanthropy. Whereas the D-Lite example is what I would call an impact investing, where you're actually really generating a financial return and you don't stand to lose your shirt if certain things aren't mentioned. But this is a big, hot item here in the UK, just so that you know. The issue is impact investing is not an asset class. It's basically a lens that you look at through which investment's made. There are two things that qualify, because many times people go, any investment I make is an impact investing. I mean, this is crazy. I mean, so one is the issue of intentionality. A pharma company obviously does a lot of good. It produces pharmaceuticals that, you know, cure illness, etc. But the intention isn't from the outset that. The intention is to generate returns and obviously to pay for their R&D costs, etc. They happen to be doing benefit for society. But from the beginning, the thing that differentiates impact investing is the whole issue of intentionality. They are actually investing with the very intention of creating that social and environmental return. And then they are very vigilant about measuring outcomes. What are the outcomes? What is the impact that these investments are having on the kinds of things that matter to us? These are still, as I said, this is a really nascent industry. There are lots of people who want jobs in this industry. There are not enough jobs in this industry because many times people that go into this, for example, come from the corporate sector. They've been in the banking sector. You know, they're tired of, you know, being in the banking sector. They want to do something that they feel is going to be more rewarding. This industry is just getting off the ground. We'll see where it goes. It's actually quite interesting. One of the ghosts that haunts this whole conversation is, well, what are acceptable returns, you know? That's the jury is still out, and I think that one of the things, again, to figure out is that this is a very nascent industry, and, you know, What is if you get if you're investing in something like a D-Lite, are you actually sacrificing financial returns for the social impact? Now, this has been a big ghost that's haunted the conversation, and interestingly enough, there's this sort of idea that somehow these kinds of impact investments always generate below market rate returns. But Deutsche Bank did a very, very interesting study where they teased apart different types of quote-unquote impact investing. And they really looked at these three categories. And what they found was the third category, which is environmental, social, and governance investments, were actually had higher rate returns, with governance as a big part of why that difference was. So that was a really interesting report. The information is beginning to come in now that shows that companies that are really looking at these aspects are actually generating higher market rate returns. So interestingly enough, the problem is we're still looking at what are the best models for impact investing. Clearly something like a Renacer is not. But there are other things that can businesses where you might want to think about, there's a business that I could develop that could actually really do both or three things, whether it's the solar lighting or mobile authentication, microinsurance, drinking water. All of these areas we're just beginning to explore in terms of what are businesses that can do these different aspects that we're looking for in terms of the role that business functions in society, how can business can really improve our society. And I want to just highlight something. Many of you, I'm sure, have heard of microfinance, right? Okay. Let me tell you a little bit about the history of Grameen. Even though microfinance has existed for years before Grameen came, Grameen basically formalized it and sort of universalized the model. But lending groups have been going on since communities started, et cetera. So don't think that microfinance, that Muhammad Yunus just, came down and gave the model of microfinance. It's been around. But in 1976, he founded Grameen. 40 years later, the microfinance sector serves millions and millions of people. And billions of euros, or UK pounds, or whatever you want to say, have been actually investing, including big pension funds, mainstream investment, banks, et cetera. Money has flowed into the MFI sector. But an awful lot of subsidy was needed. Basically, look at how much money over 30 years microfinance received in grants from whether it was the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, et cetera. It was heavily subsidized. And it's the same thing in government, by the way. Government heavily subsidizes lots of industry, as we well know. So this issue of subsidy, it's like the angel investments that's needed to grow a sector. And it's the same thing with anywhere. So it took a lot of time to build up the microfinance industry and to give it credibility, and also to build that ecosystem. We forget that today in the financial industry, we have a whole ecosystem that supports that industry, whether it's consultants, whether it's accounting firms, whether it's the legal system, I mean, a whole host of different things. We don't have that in this nascent industry of what we're calling sustainable entrepreneurship, these weird hybrid organizations that are still trying to figure out are we fish or fowl and trying to, find a new way of doing business. So all of these things, it took time to build that ecosystem. And during that time, now microfinance is a mainstream sector. Many banks have, microfinance windows within the bank. So I wanted to just close by giving you a couple of really interesting insights into where the corporate sector is going. These are some of the highlights of corporations that are really trying to figure it out. They're trying to figure out how can we actually transform the way we're doing business so that we are actually looking at reusing things that are wasted or creating a different way of doing business with our supply chain. Marks and Spencer, has the plan A, or because there's no plan B. They're all trying. None of them are succeeding completely, but they're really pivoting or trying to pivot their operations in this way. And interestingly enough, shareholders are rewarding them for that, which is interesting at this point. So we'll see where this whole trend goes, but it is exciting. Look, Waste Management is the largest waste management company in the entire U.S. Do you know that it produces more solar, more electricity, or more power, more energy from solar, from waste, than the entire solar energy sector in the United States? That is a publicly listed company, and they are purposely doing this. They're looking, how can we use waste to completely generate energy? And it's a fascinating story what they're doing. And they've had to pivot completely. The CEO of that organization came in and basically revamped the whole thing with the support of the shareholders. Sometimes shareholders aren't so crazy, in the case of, aren't so excited about it. In the case of Royal DSM, which is a fascinating company, it's the biggest producer of vitamins and other kinds of nutrients, nutritional things. It's a B2C company in Holland. It's a publicly listed company. The CEO had to almost sort of say, I'm stepping down, because this is the way I want to go. And if you're not with me, I'm stepping down. And then the shareholders stepped up and said, okay, let's try it out. So it's not, but you know, it's tension. It's tension. If you've always been driven by certain things, it's hard to change that model. But it's exciting. So this is what we call future-proofing business. Lots of different things cropping up. All of these movements around sustainable capitalism, responsible capitalism, blah, 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 blah. It keeps going and going. And all of these have different organizations that are big businesses that are part of these little clubs. And there's a huge fragmentation of effort. You see it at the WEF, you see it in the UN Global Compact. There's just a whole crop. This is a trend. Every company wants to be on this bandwagon and figure it out. So I think that they also identify that we've got mega problems. Number one, and opportunities. Yes, the climate change threat gives rise to big opportunities in the clean economy. We have major resource constraints in terms of rising commodity prices, but there's a huge growth of the middle class around the world. And then we're basically looking at much more demand on transparency, open innovation, et cetera, which presents, again, a whole other opportunity there. And just to conclude, this is why companies realize that they've got to do something. The world is getting hotter. It's getting scarcer. I mean, commodities are. It's much more transparent. You can't hide anymore. And it's very unpredictable. So how does a company actually, you know, take advantage of that? I'll just quickly run through this, and let's talk about you. I actually think there are very few of us that are going to go out and form the kinds of ventures that I've talked about at the very beginning of this talk. But there is something that all of us can do, and that's what I believe is we can be entrepreneuring wherever we are. We can be thinking innovatively from wherever we're working, even within an 800-year-old university. We can be thinking differently. We can think, how do we actually contribute to a way of leading and changing a system, or a way of fixing things that have perhaps not lived up to the kind of potential that we'd hope in a very rapidly changing world. So I really believe that the most important thing is to stop focusing as much on entrepreneurship, which has been very narrowly focused on new venture creation, which is great, but I actually think it's a much bigger piece than that. I think, as I said, you know, we can actually be entrepreneuring wherever we are. So with that, I'll conclude and just open up to any questions you might have.